Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, April 21st. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington and Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox injections, fillers, cosmetic and reconstructive surgery, BerkshirePlasticSurgeons.com. Today we welcome Dr. Alex Mostainu, System Chair of Primary Care at New Vance Health. With the weather warming up and people eager to get outside, we'll talk a little about prevention and early symptom awareness of bug-borne illnesses and allergies and asthma. But Dr. Mostainu is also ready for your questions on a wide range of topics, from family, internal, and sports medicine to geriatrics and integrative behavioral health. Number to call here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll meet Dr. Alex Mostainu and take your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Alex Mostainu, System Chair of Primary Care at New Vance Health. He is board-certified internist who oversees all aspects of primary care services, which includes family medicine, internal medicine, geriatrics, concierge medicine, sports medicine, and integrated behavioral health. Dr. Mostainu completed his internal medicine residency at Yale and went through training at Danbury Hospital, where he also served as chief resident. He is also a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Vermont. To participate in today's discussion, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the phone number. You can also email your question to voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Alex Mostainu, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ray. Thank you for the introduction.
I really appreciate you being here today. Now, when you talk about primary care, and you're the system chair at New Vance Health, you're overseeing all these things. Tell us about what your day looks like every day.
Yeah, very, very good question, right? So we do have more than 30 practices across Connecticut and Eastern New York. And, the days are complicated when our weekly meeting starts with, you're not going to believe this, right? In every practice, you have something that is going to break one way or another. And daily operations, clinical programs, when you take something as simple as controlling hypertension in the population, right? How do you come up with programs? How do you develop programs that will help people along the way? How do you get the population that you are serving to be healthier and living longer? Those are our metrics.
So you are, as I understand it here, a strategic and tactical problem solver. You're not doing hands-on medicine as much anymore?
So I'm doing hands-on medicine for about 1 to 2 days per week. My new job is actually just starting in February, so I was hands-on for all this time.
You had enough?
2011. Not necessarily. I love my job, but I thought, maybe changing a little bit the pace and seeing some other aspects of medicine, it's always interesting.
This is a time, and you're downstate a little bit from Albany, and it's even worse down there. This is tick season, and this is outdoor season, and people are out there. And we wanted to talk just as we start the show. And by the way, very general topic today. Feel free to call in with any primary care question. 800-348-2551. We wanted to talk a little bit about prevention and early detection of bug-borne illnesses. They seem to be on the rise over the last 20 or 30 years.
You're correct, Ray. And, you mentioned earlier about the primary care, right? And what is primary care? I think that you can ask any question because we are the jack of all trades and masters of none, right? So that's how I'm looking at this. And, I don't think that is anything that is outside the scope of primary care. Of course, we don't do brain surgery, but
right.
you may argue that many other things are as complex as brain surgery.
Do you want to give it a shot? There are probably a few folks around here who can use a little bit.
Absolutely, right here.
I'm not looking at anybody over there. Before we get back to bug-borne, obviously you went through years and years and years of training. What made you want to be a more medical generalist and not a specific focus?
So very interesting question. When I started the residency, I wanted to become a cardiologist. That was my desire. And then I started rotating in primary care. And I really love the variety that you see, right? I mean, imagine a day that you see 20, 25 patients and none looks like the other. It's a completely different story in any room you go. You see a tick-borne illness in room one, then you go to room two and somebody has heart disease, and then you're room three and somebody has stomach bugs, whatever. So it's a very complex specialty.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Alex Mostanu joins us from Nuvance Health. All right, let's get back to bug-borne illnesses. The weather has been, you know, we had a cold winter, and theoretically that keeps the ticks down a little bit. But things have been warming up now, and how do you... You know, there was so much controversy over Lyme disease, and there still is some. But I mean, how do you detect it and make the diagnosis?
That's a million-dollar question, right? So you cannot oversimplify the things when it comes to tick-borne diseases. It's very easy to diagnose an acute Lyme disease because somebody comes with a tick on their skin, and there is a large area of redness around. They have a fever. That's like the easy part. But then you have people that maybe had this episode, they thought that they had the flu, they get better, and then they come back again, maybe with a joint pain or migrating joint pains or some weird rashes that occur on their skin. And that's when you have to have a high level of suspicion. I always say that if you live in Northeast, right, New York, Connecticut, you always have to keep a high level of suspicion. If you go to a doctor in New York City, they might not be able to diagnose it. If you're staying local, your local primary care will be actually more likely to find what's going on because we are used to what's going on in our communities. And recently, I just read an article about one of my colleagues in Nuvance, in one of the big journals in the New York. And they actually noted how remarkable her diagnosis was of a rare tick-borne disease, which for us is bread and butter.
You know, the thing is, for those who are bitten and never see the tick, and the tick is gone and life goes on, and then down the road you mentioned migrating joint pain or whatever else, how do you make a hard diagnosis a year or two, three, four, five after the fact?
Yeah, so it's a blood work test. We test for antibodies against Lyme disease. We test antibodies for babesiosis, which is another disease, and anaplasmosis. These are all diseases that that can come from ticks. And depending on the results and the level of suspicion, you make a diagnosis. It's blood tests by themselves don't tell the entire story. The story by itself doesn't tell the entire story. So it's a combination of the two. You know, you have to have a level of suspicion plus examination plus blood work.
Now, antibiotics kill the thing?
Yes.
Always.
So yes, always. This is something that is very controversial, right, in the medical world. Depending on who you ask, 15% of patients, so 1.5%, do end up developing some prolonged symptoms after they are treated with antibiotics. This is where people cannot agree. Is it a chronic Lyme, meaning that the bacteria is still persisting in the bloodstream, or is that the inflammation, the reaction that the body has is still persisting? I think that if you ask 100 clinicians, probably you're going to get 20 or 30 that will give different views of the problem.
All right, I'm asking you, what do you think?
I think that you kill the bacteria. I think that we are dealing with prolonged symptoms from inflammation. And there are actually genetically identified individuals that cannot clear up certain parts of the bacteria, not alive bacteria, but still circulating parts of the bacteria that are not completely destroyed.
Now, separate category here, but are we dealing with a similar phenomenon with long-term COVID, so-called long-term COVID?
So there are similarities between the two diseases, and long-term COVID is one. A lot of people and some of your listeners know about mononucleosis, which is a disease that many of us heard, it's nothing big, or some of us heard that, people have been devastated, losing a year from school because they cannot...
The kissing disease, right?
The kissing disease, you're right. Very well. So, again, it is the response that the body has to different type of viruses. We know that we are so genetically variable. Like, we have people that actually they are resistant to HIV virus. You can take them, inject them with HIV, and they are not going to get HIV because there are certain genetic traits that make us resistant to viruses. And also there are genetic traits that makes us significantly more sensitive to viruses.
We're joined today by Dr. Alex Mostanu of Nuvance Health. The number here is 800-348-2551. Tell you what, we'll take a quick break. I want to ask you about what the heck concierge medicine is, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff back with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Alex Mostanu of Nuvance Health. And before we get to the phones, in your long list of specialties, one of the things you oversee as System Chair of Primary Care at Nuvance Health is concierge medicine. What's that?
Great question, Ray. So, you know, we all went to see our primary care physician for those, whatever, 5 to 7 minutes. That is the average time that most patients spend with their doctors. And that has been shortening and shortening over the last few years. So some people want a little bit more time with their doctor, want to have a little bit better access. And slowly, a new branch of primary care has developed called concierge medicine, where people pay a small fee or big fee, a larger fee, depending on
well,
how you look at it.
Let's not talk fees.
Yeah. And part of that, you have better access, that clinician is not as stressed to see 25 people a day to make the day's end. And they can see less patients, so you have more time with your clinician. And then you get a more personalized touch from your physician. So.
I mean, is this a symptom of a problem where primary docs don't have enough time because they're trying to get enough patients in to make the bottom line work?
So it's not only the bottom line, is that we have to serve our communities, right? And when you look at something like Nuvance Health, right, we are dedicated to the community. That's what we want to make sure that we offer access for people in the communities. And it's very hard to see, you know, when you have a panel of 2,500 patients, you have to see 25 patients a day, and then you only have 7-8 hours of seeing patients in a day, and you have to put a lot of patients per hour. In concierge medicine, then you have a much a smaller footprint, right? You only have like 600 patients in a panel, so it's much easier to see those patients. But I agree with you. I think that it's a symptom of an overstretched system.
So we need more doctors?
I do believe so. Yes.
Okay. Number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Alex Mostanu of Nuvance Health, and we'll begin in Saugerties. Diane, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question about the bullseye rash that is, I guess, typical of a tick bite and Lyme disease. I was told that rash can appear not where the tick bite is, but it could appear somewhere else on your body.
True or not true, doctor?
Diane, hi. You're right. So while a lot of the tick bites occur, the bullseye rash can occur at the tick bite mark. There, this is in early phase, but that is something called the disseminated early phase, where the bullseyes can appear on multiple places on the body. They can be single or multiple. Bullseye don't stay in one place. That's why they are called scientifically erythema chronicum migrans, ECMs. So they appear in one side of the body, they disappear, they can appear in another part. These are kind of, think of them like bubbling up if you look at a sparkling water, right? The bubbles come up in different places. That's the same with the bacteria coming out on the skin in different places on your body. So yes, it can occur at various places in your body, not necessarily the tick bite area.
Does it have to appear at all?
Great.
Good question. Not necessarily, or you may not be able to see it. And some of the patients don't have a bullseye at all.
Interesting. Diane, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dr. Alex Mostanu today from Nuvance Health. We'll go to Whittingham, Vermont. And George, you're on.
Hey, Doug. Thank you for taking my call, doctor. I picked up a tick Friday on a hike, and 4 o'clock in the morning, I realized it. No, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I was itching my leg, discovered it. It was extremely tiny, one of the little teeny ones. I scratched it. It wasn't doing much. I actually pulled it off with a little bink and dropped it down the drain. It didn't look like it was feeding, but I had a red spot where it had been. I tried to pinch it a little bit, thinking I'd bleed it out if there was anything in there. There didn't seem to be any blood at all. But now, a day later, 2 days later, I've got a lump, and it itches.
Uh-oh. Yeah. So, George, thank you for calling. So, you know, one of the things, right, when you look at these tick bites, we do think about the risk of getting Lyme disease and other Lyme-associated diseases. And we say, you know, if you had a tick that is on your skin for more than 24 hours, is embedded and is full of blood, you probably need to get an antibiotic for prophylaxis in the next 24 to 48 hours. So, you know, without seeing that redness, you cannot make a determination. Is it Lyme disease? Is it just a reaction from the tick? I do think that it's probably a good idea to check with somebody, you know, like an urgent care or your primary care physician to take a look over that.
George.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
All right. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. You mentioned a genetic predisposition to become ill from things like this. Are some people bitten and never present any symptoms at all?
So it's estimated that some people might be resistant to these bacteria, right? And we don't know the percentage of people that might not have receptors. We know that some people can get the Lyme disease and can actually cure it. The body will respond to the bacteria, and you can cure it like you cure your flu, right? You get over it without any treatment. So it is possible. We don't know the percentage. It's not very, very clear. So still a lot to be studied.
We're joined today by Dr. Alex Mostanu of New Vance Health. The number is 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's say we go down to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Well, apparently, pyroplasmosis is coming up the East Coast due to the Asian longhorn tick. The etiological agent is Babesia bigemina. Pathogenesis was worked out over 100 years ago by Theobald Smith, a veterinarian, although Robert Koch, the MD on the project, got the credit for it.
All right. Is there a question there? Well, Jim is gone. All right. Well, Jim, thank you for that. Our guest today is Dr. Alex Mostanu of New Vance Health, 800-348-2551. Now you understand, you kind of go with the flow here as the show progresses, and you never know what you're going to get. It's like a box of chocolates. Jan or Jan in Johnstown, you're on.
Hi, I'm very interested in this. I actually used to be in the media, and I've studied the Lyme disease because I may have been bitten more than once. I had to have a pacemaker put in because my heart rate went in half from 80 to 40. So it may be the Lyme carditis. Now, they gave me three drugs that the CDC had recommended for that for stage one Lyme disease, doxycycline, amoxicillin, and ceftriaxone. Now, you can take either the amoxicillin or the doxycycline. But we didn't know at the time, and I took both. And actually, my heart came back to a one-to-one sinus rhythm. The problem was it took a long time. I know that I believe the antibiotics, oral, are not normally given for Lyme carditis, but this worked. But they were afraid to extend them because I was getting into longer and longer period of time. So they stopped it. And unfortunately, I'm right back in heart block right now.
Oh, boy.
So I need to know where to call the doctor, his phone number, and also a good spelling for his last name.
Okay, well, doctor, you spell the last name, and then we'll give you a website. We really don't do, like, a referral service on the show, but we'll give you – you can go to New Vance Health and probably find out about services, right?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, I think that this is a more complex problem that probably a cardiology and an infection disease specialist will need to see the to see you for that, Jan. And you mentioned, you know, you're already on 3 antibiotics. So how much is just Lyme disease and how much is now a structural heart disease? It's very hard to say.
And doctor, I'll try to spell your last name correctly. It's Mosteanu.
That's correct.
All right. There you go, Jan. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Primary care today with Dr. Alex Mosteanu of New Vance Health. Laura writes in from Enfield, Connecticut. I've been a patient for 8 years with my concierge MD, and I'm thrilled with his care. Everything about this program is a win. The future in healthcare makes me confident my healthcare will not be overlooked. How lucky I am. There you go.
Absolutely.
But costs are more, right? Is this an elitist thing? Will only the rich people be able to afford this?
Well, it depends, right? So, at the price of a haircut per month, you can get in a concierge program with a physician. So, depending on how you look at the cost, right? There are people that buy a coffee every day from the store, and if you multiply that by 30 days in a month, you're probably paying on the coffee more than you're going to pay for a physician. So depending on how you look at their health, I'm looking at the health as an investment in your future.
Okay, well, just inside baseball here, but I'm too cheap to buy coffee or haircuts. So there you go. So maybe I'm not a good candidate. Peter in Berryville, New York writes in, I was hospitalized several years ago with Lyme. I had rashes all over my body, flu-like symptoms. I was released from the hospital with a PIC line, I don't know what that is, which I had for almost a month. Even if I am not reinfected with a new bite, will I still test positive for this disease after all of these years? In other words, is the bacteria ever out of my system? And that's from Peter in Berryville.
So that's a great question for Peter. So when you look at what we test, we actually test your body reaction to the bacteria, not the bacteria itself.
Uh-huh.
So your body will continue to make those antibodies. Like, for example, a good example would be people that had chickenpox, right? They will always have the antibodies, but not necessarily have the continuous chickenpox, or even giving another example, the measles, right? Before 1958, was very, very common for people to get measles. They will continue to test positive with antibodies against measles. So going back to the Lyme, yes, very high chance that your antibodies will remain positive for a very long time, 20, 30 years, even lifetime.
Interesting. Now, why can't you test for the bacteria directly?
So there are some tests with the PCR, but they are not that precise. And when we look at the sensitivity of a test, meaning the ability to detect the disease when the disease is there, it remains very low. And also specificity, meaning showing that when you have the disease, you truly have the disease, right? And that's also very low. So those tests are not very good to identify the bacteria. We can do Lyme tests in a joint fluid, for example, and we can identify the bacteria there because they are more concentrated, but not in the blood because they are not that concentrated.
Dr. Alex Mosteanu joins us today from New Vance Health. It's 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Karen is in Salt Point, New York. Hello, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty well. How are you?
I'm good. My question is to the doctor that on April 5th, I found a tick on me in the middle of the night. I just, for some reason, I was just itchy, and I just pulled it off, and when I went to look at it, I saw that it was engorged. So, and it was still alive. I just flushed it down the toilet. This was 15 days ago. I don't have any kind of bullseye. I do have a red mark where the tick was attached. I don't have any symptoms. And my question is, when would I get symptoms? When would they develop?
Karen, that's a great question. Thank you. So generally, symptoms can develop in the first month after getting the tick bite. So watching for symptoms, you know, redness, weird rashes, joint pain, fever, muscle aches. for about a month. And that's an important point also, that not all the bites will transmit the Lyme disease. Not even a bite that from a tick that is infected with Lyme disease will not necessarily be 100% that will transmit the disease. So just watch the symptoms and, you know, anything unusual, contact your primary care.
All right, Karen, thank you very much. Number here is 800-348-2551. Couple questions. Folk wisdom. Yeah, people say, oh, you got a tick bite, you take it out with one of those tong devices and you bring it to the doc. Is that a good idea, to bring the tick to the doc?
Yeah, not unless it's something wrong with the tick and you want us to fix it.
But,
no, okay. So in all seriousness, right, when you look at the tick bites, even if they are infected with the Lyme, there's not 100% chance that you're going to get the tick disease. Some people bring them to the town, and it's used for the epidemiologic purposes, meaning the knowing how many of the ticks are infected.
Yeah.
I don't think that is a huge value of bringing the tick to
to
the physician.
I think I've actually done that once, brought it to the doc, and they kind of shrugged their shoulders. The other thing is, if you are bitten, you don't know it. A year later, several months later, you start exhibiting symptoms. Will the antibiotics do anything, or is it too late by that point?
So the antibiotics do help.
Yeah.
Right? So we just had the example of that listener that mentioned that developed Lyme carditis, meaning an infection in the heart with the Lyme disease that required treatment to the antibiotics, and that got reversed. So the answer is yes, antibiotics will help down the road.
Okay. An email here, then we'll take a break, and then we'll go back to the phones. Dr. Alex Mostanu from Nuvance Health joins us. 800-348-2551 is the number. Okay, this is from Francis. I've had Lyme disease twice, hospitalized for anaplasmosis once. I always gave blood to Red Cross at least twice a year. I've been told that once one has had Lyme disease, they can no longer use my blood, even if I want to continue to donate. Is this correct?
So that's a very good question. I don't know all the guidelines that Red Cross is using these days, but certain tests, for example, antibodies against Lyme disease, will remain positive for a very long time. So some of the blood banks may be worried that they may not be able to detect Lyme disease in the blood. So they may want that. They may not want to have this his blood used. But I'm not so sure about. So I would say, ask again. Make sure that this is Lyme disease, sometimes babesiosis. That's one that we are very worried about, the transfusions. That's a parasite that can be transmitted by the ticks, and that's a little bit harder to detect.
What are you seeing most in the primary care field at this time of year? Is it allergies? Is it colds? What's the biggest thing on your radar as system chair of primary care at Nuvance Health?
Yeah, so we just came after a very busy virus season, flu and colds and everything else. I think that the allergies are getting pretty fast up there. But I remember the first day when we started crossing the 40 degrees barrier, right? And I just got bombarded on a Friday afternoon with like 20 calls with, hey, doc, I have this tick on me, is engorged. I need antibiotics. I have a rash. So I think that right now, with people being more active, coming out of their houses, doing yard work and everything, I think tick-borne diseases will start picking up very fast.
So would you recommend people never leave their house?
Very good question.
Yeah.
No.
No? Okay. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Dr. Alex Mostanu joins us from Nuvance Health. We'll be back with more of your calls and your emails coming up. Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Alex Mostanu of Nuvance Health. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Mostanu is System Chair of Primary Care at Nuvance Health, covers a lot of bases in that job, and then sees patients a day or two a week. It's a busy, busy life. Let's go back to the phones, and we go to Wappingers Falls. Mary, you're on.
Hi. My question is regarding something I heard about. Being able to, after you've gotten bit by a tick, being prescribed a couple of, I think, doxycycline to help almost like stave off the effects of any potential difficulties from the tick bite.
Mary, your information is quite correct. So if we have a tick that is embedded and engorged and has been there for more than 24 hours, we want in the next 36 hours to prescribe an antibiotic like doxycycline, high dose, two tablets of 100 milligrams, so a total of 200 milligrams of doxycycline. And that's shown to be quite protective. 90% of the Lyme disease can be avoided this way. Now, you still have to deal with babesiosis, which is a much less common parasite infection that can still persist despite the doxycycline, and it's not very clear if that dose will protect against anaplasmosis. So yes, I do recommend, and CDC recommends the doxycycline antibiotic in this condition. But again, this is not 100%. This is not foolproof way of preventing Lyme disease.
Mary.
Okay.
All right.
Good to know. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Alex Mostanu from New Vance Health. And we'll go to John in beautiful Unadilla. John, you're on.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, more or less. It sounds like you're on the space shuttle, but I think we'll make it out.
Okay, thank you. Is this better?
Yeah, you're fine there. Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, I'm a retired medical oncologist, and I was curious about a totally different topic. I hope that's okay.
That's fine.
The increasing role of AI in medical practice. There's an amazing article in the New England Journal a couple of weeks ago about the role of AI as opposed to nothing, patients with mental health issues. And there was a marked improvement across the spectrum with just AI. And people obviously had prior interactions with providers felt it was just as good as the providers. I just wondered how your doctor feels that the role it will play across the board in the future, what his thoughts are. It was amazing. I was completely surprised. Actually.
Did you see that article, Doc?
Yes. John, thank you so much for this call and this question. I think that this is great because we are talking about the concierge medicine, right? And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have the ability to interact with the AI that is amazing, and it seems to be improving. I think that, Ray, you mentioned earlier about the lack of clinicians in the country, right?
Yeah.
When you look at statistics, they think that by 2035, probably we're going to have 70,000. We will need more, another 70,000 doctors in primary care. So how much of this work AI is going to take is still a question. But I agree with John. I think that's amazing results coming from AI. And they may be able to diagnose some simple and not that simple conditions.
So, and John, thanks for the call. So when we say AI is benefiting medicine, this is strictly as a diagnostic tool?
It can be diagnostic tool or it can be treatment tool. John mentioned that he's a retired oncologist. Oncology is one of the fields that changes all the time, and there are new trials. We used to think that the medical knowledge doubles every 1.5 years. Now it seems to be doubling every 2 weeks. How can you keep up with that, right? So this is where you need to assistance of a computer. So I think that AI will be either having a role of assisting physicians or doing the job to a certain point for the physicians. I don't think there's going to be a complete replacement.
Now, I'm an old timer, but I have a certain amount of trepidation about this because I've seen what some of these AI engines will do, and they'll call it hallucinating. But basically wrong answers. And when you're dealing with someone's health, you got to make sure you're right. So how do you trust it, I guess?
Yeah. So, we are all flying, right? I mean, we took planes and we flew over. A lot of the work is done by AI assisted by the pilots, for example, right? That's my understanding from actually a pilot. So this AI is involved in a lot of our other fields that either we know it or we don't. So the idea that you'll have something that will assist you and present you with the right data at the right time, I think that's what I see the role of AI.
We're joined today by Dr. Alex Mostanu of Nuvance Health, and this email from Pedro at voxpop@wamc.org. Pedro writes, I've heard that when someone is infected, the Lyme bacteria spirochete for a long time will have to have a long-term antibiotic to flood the bloodstream, since this spirochete will hide on a cyclical basis. It'll hide? Is that true?
So depending on who you ask, right, there's going to be a group of physicians that believe you're going to need a very prolonged course of antibiotics. There is no clear data for that. I don't completely, in medicine, you don't want to be 100% or 0%. Yeah. I don't think that's right. My belief is that this is a bacteria that is very sensitive at this time to any antibiotics. It doesn't really hide in a lot of places. And some of the places that it can hide, joints and things like this, you will know if it's hiding there because it's going to be very painful, very swollen. And in this case, we use different antibiotics. But I don't believe that a very prolonged course, months and months, will be necessary because those have their own risks.
You know, in a general sense, in primary care, we have heard for years, more than years, decades, about people using and being prescribed and using too much antibiotics. Are we at risk of flooding the system in this case?
I believe so. I believe that, we are using too much antibiotics. And, our kind of knowledge around antibiotics has evolved significantly over the last 20 years. We used to say, take antibiotics for 14 days. Don't ever stop it before, right? How did we come up to the 14 days? Well, there are 2 weeks. That sounded fine. Let's use 2 weeks. And then we started shortening 10 days because we have 10 fingers, then 7 days because that's what a week is, then 5 days because that's what the hand fingers are. So we don't know for sure what is the duration, but now we are experimenting with shorter and shorter courses because we believe that probably shorter courses are better. So one thing that is for sure, medicine always changing, new trials are coming in. We just spoke earlier about doubling up the information. So,
yeah. All right, let's go back to our phone lines at 800-348-2551. Dr. Alex Mostanu joins us, and now we go to Saratoga Lake. And Greg, you're on. Greg.
Hey, Ray, thanks for taking the call, doctor.
You
appreciate your input here. It's just a very nice thing you're doing. Ray, kind of a case study I just wanted to tell you about, then a question.
Okay.
About 3 years ago, I'm a real outdoor person. I'm very healthy, whatever. And I started feeling one afternoon, I'd been kind of like mowing my grass or whatever, and I started feeling a little bit funny, didn't think about it, knew I wasn't sick. Anyway, went out to consider going to get some groceries or whatever, and I felt faint as I got near my car, and I said, it'll pass. And it was debilitating.
Really?
I slowly fell down, and I'm a very healthy, good-sized guy. I could not get up.
Wow.
And fortunately, my neighbor saw me struggling to grab onto the mirror of my car, and even then, I couldn't get up.
Holy moly.
And she came over, are you having a heart attack? I said, I don't think so. Turns out they sent me over to Saratoga Hospital, and I was there. It was a holiday weekend, if I recall, and I was there like 2 or 3 hours, and they did the blood test, and it was clearly diagnosed as anaplasmosis. And by the time they did the whole symptom thing and the regimentation with the, I can't remember which, it was one of the antibiotics, they kept me overnight. And the next day by noon, it was like nothing had ever happened.
Wow. The doc is nodding his head.
So why am I saying this? Strangely enough, I have a bachelor's in public health. This whole scene has caused us to be so aware of, you can't just go out anymore with shorts and go hiking. You really have to do this and do that. My question to the doctor is, and I don't work for one of the off-brand spray repellent things.
Okay.
What can we do, doctor, other than just covering our bodies? Is there a lotion or something that you can think, maybe some old wives' tale, where we can put it on before we go out? Because we've got a real, real serious issue going on here.
Greg, thank you so much for this question. And you know, as you're presenting the your situation, right? There are not many things that can make people sick so fast and so brutally, and then you touch them with antibiotics and they get like 100% better by the next day. That's anaplasmosis.
Yep.
It's an amazing disease. And to your question, right? You can use sprays with DEET, you know, that contain DEET, and you want to use a DEET concentration that is higher than 25%. A lot of people don't like the smell. It's kind of sticky on the skin. Some people get irritation and allergies to the DEET. Or clothes that are saturated with permethrin, which is an insecticide. But at the end of the day, having a mechanical barrier, right? You know, long socks, tucking in your pants in the socks, and making sure that you wear light colors clothes. I think that's the protection you need.
Light colors, you said?
Correct. Things don't like light colors because they are very visible, right?
Really?
So they want to camouflage.
Yep.
So just wear white, you know, that's your plan there, Greg. Thanks a lot. You know, again, I mentioned this the other day or last week at one point during a show. On the Pets and Vet shows that I do once a month, we have vets in and they talk about these collars, Seresto and otherwise, that work tremendously well on animals. Why can't we have those? Why can't people have those? You go out in the woods.
That's very interesting, right? I don't think that they really studied for humans and see how that works. And pets have something a little bit different than us. They have a lot of fur. And
yeah.
I think that that's
not a good plan.
I'm not sure. Plus, the size doesn't help.
Okay. Well, yeah, it'll be huge and very expensive. Okay. Helena writes in from Amherst, Massachusetts. What exactly is pneumonia? Is it just an infection of some kind deep in the lungs? Is it contagious? What kinds of infections cause it? How do you know when it's gone? I know lots of deep coughing can be a symptom. Treatments? And that's from Helena in Amherst.
So that's a great question, right? Pneumonia is not that easy to diagnose and is not the same for everyone. When you look at pneumonia, it's a deep infection of the lungs. Typically fever, cough.
Bacterial?
It can be bacterial or viral. Actually, the most pneumonias are viral.
Okay.
And usually you can cure them with antibiotics for bacteria or for the viruses. It's kind of waiting for it to go away. It's something that is treatable. It can be quite severe, and some people can get very, very sick and end up in the hospital or even intensive care units.
Now, Helena also says, you know, can it be contagious?
So depending on the type of pneumonia, viral pneumonia surely can be contagious. The mycoplasma pneumonia, for example, which we had over the fall, quite a lot of cases of mycoplasma pneumonia, and it typically infects people in schools or barracks or, you know, that are in close proximity can be contagious. Other pneumonias, no. You know, we all hear about something called aspiration pneumonia, which is the pneumonia that people get from aspirating their own secretion. Is something that tends to happen to us when we get very old and we are not able to manage the secretions very well.
So you can make yourself sick.
Correct.
Well, what kind of chance does that give us? Let's go to Sue in Valencia. You're on with Dr. Alex Mostanu.
Hi, I'm going back to Lyme disease. Okay. I have a lot of friends that live in Connecticut that have had a lot of problems with Lyme disease. And some of them have said they have tested negative but have really been positive. Is that a common event?
So this can happen, right? We discussed earlier about the sensitivity and specificity of a test, meaning that the ability of the test to detect the disease when it's there. And nothing is 100%. So yes, the answer is yes, you can have a negative test and you can still have Lyme disease. That's why the story is important. That's why, you know, kind of understanding where this person has been. And that's where we were talking about AI earlier, right? How is going to AI going to take this into consideration?
Sue.
Yes. Good. Thank you. That helped.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thank you. Appreciate the call. This is from C. I had Lyme and Bartonella about 12 years ago. After a lengthy course of antibiotics and suffering the consequences of those, I had ultraviolet light therapy treatments. After several treatments, I've been absolutely fine. No more issues. Do you know about this treatment? I understand it's used in Europe and wondering why it's not approved for use in our medical community.
So that's a great, absolutely great question, right? So certain things that are approved in Europe are not necessarily approved in the U.S. or not experimenting enough. Even the bacteria, right, for Lyme disease is a little bit different in Europe than it is in the United States. For example, Europeans use Zithromycin for treating the Lyme disease, which we cannot use because for us it has a resistance. So the other question is it truly that is a chronic infection, or is it the reaction that the body has to the bacteria that we were discussing earlier? UV light may help with our immunity, and lowering the immunity, then you start feeling better. So we know, like many of us, we have gone to the beach, and you stay on the beach, we have a relaxing day, nothing stresses us, and then the next day we have a cold sore because our immunity has been decreasing because of the sun. Right, so I'm not very sure. You know, I don't know a lot about the UV radiation treatment, but it may have something to do with the immunity.
Interesting. I'm confused about how it is applied and used in Europe. Now, UV on the skin will affect other organs in the system, or do you have to go inside with a light and blast whatever is illing you?
No, so this should be on the skin, right? And yeah. The skin has receptor for UV, and that's why we get a tan when we stay out in the sun. So those receptors will also turn certain mechanisms in our body, turn them down, and so our immunity decreases a little bit. Our body is very efficient, right? We discussed earlier about the colds that we have in the winter. So we have more antibodies in the winter when you are cooped up and trying to fight these diseases.
Yeah.
In the summer, probably you don't need that much, so our immunity changes in the UV light. So
very interesting. All right, we only have about 2 minutes left here. Dr. Alex Mostanu joins us from New Vance Health. Let's go back to the hideous days of the pandemic and what you have learned about healthcare and maybe flaws in our system of healthcare here in this country and what could be better and how patients reacted to that pandemic. What lessons have you learned?
Yeah, so that's very interesting. So about 6 months before the pandemic started, I read a very interesting book about the six major pandemics that the world had. And what I learned during the pandemic is that we followed the same steps that those six pandemics in the past had. If you look at the plague during the Caesar in antiquity Rome, we kind of went through the same phases. So what I learned is that our healthcare is very resilient and very adaptable, but us as a humanity, we behave the same way as we behaved in antiquity.
What can we do better as a human race?
That's going to be very interesting. It's a social experiment every time you have a pandemic going on.
In your mind, did you think that the medical community, and I don't know if you were at Danbury Hospital then or where you were at that time, but did you guys do a good job? Would you say there's something we could have done better as a medical community?
So I think that we've done a tremendous job for something that we didn't know how to treat. One example was like in the first few days, we used to intubate the patients very early. And then we learned very, very fast that actually if we delay the intubation, that's going to be life-saving for our patients. And it actually that changed everything that we do now regarding the patients when they get admitted to the hospital. We are not that fast to put a tube in their throat thinking that we are going to save their lives. We know we understand more than some of the things that we do. We may believe they have positive consequences, but may have negative consequences. So it's amazing how fast we learn something that would have taken us tens of years to learn.
Well, it's a tough way to learn a lesson, but we learned a few. Dr. Alex Mostanu, thanks for being on the show. Great job.
Thank you so much.
Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live and age gracefully with dignity and respect. daughtersofsarah.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Alex Mostanu of New Vance Health for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Thanks to our intrepid engineer, Zachary Malloy. Thanks to Ed Rosen for screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's history with Kathy Sheehan from the Hart Clewitt Museum. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.